am a Buddhist meditation teacher, and have been teaching, been a Buddhist teacher for over 10 years, and I've been practicing Buddhism and Buddhist meditation for over 25 years. I practiced first in the Zen tradition for many years, and then I went to Southeast Asia and was introduced to the mindfulness tradition there, and fell very much in love with it and found it to be a very powerful practice. And then came back to this country, continued practice here, and then was trained by Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana teacher, a teacher of insight meditation or mindfulness meditation. I showed up in this community in the Palo Alto area in 1990 when I started a graduate program at Stanford in, of all things, Buddhist studies, and which I finished a couple of years ago. And so during that time that I was studying, this group here grew, and we eventually became incorporated, and we're now known as the Insight Meditation Center of the Mid Peninsula because we couldn't think of any shorter name. That we tried, and we've grown, and now we have three meetings a week, the Monday evenings and this Thursday evening, and then Sunday morning in Portola Valley. And then we have other events that happen during the month, various things that happen. It's one of my favorite things to do is to come and teach this introductory course, partly because I get to share with you something that I find very precious, something I enjoy and love a lot. And partly I enjoy it because I'm never quite sure what I'm going to say. So I get to find out too. let me ask you then, how many of you are new to meditation? Okay, and how many of you and how many of you are new to mindfulness meditation or insight meditation? Should be a bigger group. Okay, so the course is, this 5-week course is basically oriented towards people who are brand new, don't know much about practice. And now the mindfulness meditation or mindfulness practice that I'll be teaching comes from the Buddhist tradition. It's considered to be kind of the cream of Buddhist practice, or the pinnacle of Buddhist practice. And it's a little bit unusual to teach it in the Buddhist context. It's a little bit unusual to teach it to people straight out, as if it can be taught independent of its Buddhist context. However, here in the West, we've made a specialty out of teaching mindfulness to people without much of the Buddhist context, just kind of offered straight to people. Part of the motivation for that is that the mindfulness practice is very powerful in its own right, very effective and very helpful for people in their lives. And we made a decision, those of us who are teaching here, that we would like to make that this powerful practice effective to people without the burden, without the obstacle of feeling that they have to then encounter Buddhism or learn about Buddhism or become a Buddhist or anything. For me, I'm a Buddhist teacher, and I'm teaching it in a Buddhist context to some degree. But I want to make it clear to you, those of you who are not interested in Buddhism, that you don't have to listen to that part of it. Mm-hmm. It's, as you wish. It's not essential for what we're teaching here. This practice comes from Southeast Asia. Originally came from India. Buddhism died out in India, and this particular practice of mindfulness survived in Southeast Asia, and it's people who went to Southeast Asia, mostly Westerners who went there in the 60s and 70s, who then learned about it there, became teachers, and came back to this country and started teaching in the 70s and the 80s. Probably the tradition in America was about 25 years old. But in that time, it's had a tremendous impact in many places in our society. One of the places that I think has been most dramatic is in pain and stress clinics. It's kind of completely left its Buddhist context, and people go to pain and stress reduction clinics at Stanford and all over the country, different hospitals, to help with acute pain or help with a lot of stress in their life. And they're taught the mindfulness practice without even knowing that it's Buddhist. It comes from Buddhism. And it's become a whole movement of pain and stress reduction clinics all over. There's been a big impact in certain areas of psychotherapy. Many psychotherapists have studied Buddhism and are very much influenced in their work by the contact, particularly with the insight meditation, the mindfulness practice. I use the word mindfulness, insight meditation, interchangeable. The Pali or Sanskrit, the Pali word, the Buddhist word for it, is vipassana. So you might hear me say that, use that word sometimes. Vipassana literally means to see clearly, clear seeing. And that's what we're cultivating and developing when we do mindfulness, is to see clearly. Now, why do we want to see clearly? What's the point? One of the points of it is that, as in Buddhism and as in many spiritual traditions, say that the average normal person kind of living their lives tends to live a life that's from a spiritually developed point of view where they're asleep. They're not really awake or clear or conscious of what's really going on in their daily life. And to see clearly is to begin to lift the veils of delusion or illusion or distraction or preoccupation that prevents us from seeing clearly what's going on in our life. There was a story from the time of the Buddha of they didn't have this word, but it's basically a translation, I think, of the Sanskrit Pali word. A bunch of dilettantes, young guys who were kind of sons of wealthy families and had a lot of wealth and a lot of free time and just were kind of dilettanting their lives and stuff. And they went to a park or forested area one day with a courtesan, a prostitute, to do whatever young dilettantes do. And at some point, after their feast and picnic and all that, they all fell asleep. And the text described these, the young men, wealthy young men of ancient India would have lots of makeup on. I think they were painted blue. They had blue makeup on. They had lots of earrings and necklaces and, quite well-to-do. And so they fell asleep. And then while they were all sleeping, napping after their picnic, the courtesan lifted all the jewelry from them and left. So when they woke up and there was no jewelry left, and they were quite upset, and they started going through the forest looking for her. And they came across the Buddha, who was having his afternoon meditation underneath a tree, just sitting quietly, very peacefully. And they came upon him, and they said, "Have you seen this woman running away with all our jewelry?" And the Buddha calmly replied, "What would you rather find, the woman or yourself?" And maybe his timing was just right, because they all stopped and they forgot about the woman. They sat down to hear what he had to say. And this idea of finding ourselves, seeing who we are in some deep way, is a very important theme in Buddhist practice. And most of us are not chasing after courtesans who have stolen our goods, but many of us are chasing after all kinds of things. Some of them would seem, perfectly reasonable things to chase after, but it's a chasing after which is often the problem. We get preoccupied and get stressed with our concerns about status, our concerns about relationships, our concerns about work, our concerns about how people see us, who we want to be. There's a lot of things that add up to a certain level of stress in our lives, a certain level of preoccupation in our lives, where it's very hard then to really know who we are. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to stop and learn to see clearly underneath the normal conventional ideas that we have about what's important in life and who we think we are, and go underneath the level of who we think we are to actually the level of actually who we are. There being considered to be a huge gap between who we think we are and what we actually are. And because many of us live in our thinking of who we are, thinking about the world, we often keep ourselves somewhat removed from a deeper contact with ourselves, a deeper sense of what happens with us and who we actually are. So the Buddha said, would you rather find the courtesan or you would rather find yourself? Would you rather, what is most important? In the Buddhist context, mindfulness is related to the quest of really finding out deeply who we are. Many people who engage in mindfulness practice do it not for such deep kind of existential quest or spiritual quest, but do it simply because it's a very effective and powerful way of reducing stress in our lives. It's in a sense, it helps us cope a lot. Some people, in learning to do mindfulness, will just simply learn how to cope in their sleepwalking better. And that's okay. But ultimately, the idea is to break through our sleepwalking, and the Buddhist word is to wake up. The word Buddha comes from the Sanskrit word to be awake. And just to be more awake in our life is the goal. And if we live more awake in our life, then there'll be less stress, there'll be less anxiety, less fear, and we'll feel an increased sense of connectedness with the people around us. Increased sense of connectedness with the present moment. The present moment borders on being the god of Buddhism. The present moment is very, very important. And one of the reasons for this is the present moment is the only place, I believe, where we're able to experience and appreciate that which is most valuable for us in our lives. I think you'll be hard-pressed to find something in your life that you find really, really valuable that you don't experience in the present moment. Friendship, joy, love, peace. Most things are experienced in the present moment. Someone challenged me once and thought that sleep also qualified. But sleep you're not really present for. They really loved sleep. But I think most of us, the things we most love in life are experienced, you have to be in the present in order to experience them. The memory of friendship and love is kind of like, it's wonderful in itself, or memory of past joys or future possibilities of joy is, it's wonderful in its own right, but it's wonderful in the same way as reading a menu is wonderful. You know, it's kind of nice to read a menu, but sooner or later you better eat. So we eat the present moment. And that's what mindfulness is helping us do, to savor it. So today I'm emphasizing that one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to help us know ourselves better. As I talk about this mindfulness practice over these 5 weeks, I'll slide back and forth between talking about it as a meditation practice and talking about it as a practice that we do in our daily life. And it might be a little bit confusing for you, but there's no sharp division between what happens in meditation and what happens in our normal life. Thus, our heart and our mind is the same. And most people who have a regular meditation practice, sooner or later, will realize that the division between meditation and outside meditation is arbitrary. And they'll find a kind of an inspiration inside of them to want to bring some of the composure, some of the peace, some of the insight they get from meditation into the normal life, to integrate it so that they can have some of that composure in their normal life also. So I'll slide back and forth. It won't always be so obvious if I'm talking about meditation or talking about bringing mindfulness in daily life. Meditation is a very important part of learning mindfulness. Some people refer to meditation, sitting in meditation posture, as being kind of learning mindfulness with training wheels. Because to learn to try to be mindful in normal life is actually quite hard. We get very easily pulled into our thoughts, our reactions, our concerns, the busyness, our forward momentum, our drivenness that we have. And just look and see how mindful you can be while you're speaking. Most people lose their mindfulness when they speak. Sometimes I see people who speak, and there's a kind of addictive quality. They're kind of like, glaze goes over their eyes, and they're off and running, telling you the latest story, their concern. So it's going to be very hard to do it in daily life. And so sitting in meditation is kind of like training wheels, kind of creating a very useful, pragmatic place, time, conditions, where it optimizes our ability to begin strengthening the mindfulness. As if mindfulness is kind of like a muscle of increased awareness and clear seeing that can be strengthened. And so we choose, like we go to the gym to optimally to strengthen our muscles. So, you know, we sit down in formal meditation practice in order to begin finding some way to strengthen our capacity of seeing clearly, of being in the present moment, staying in the present moment. The muscle of hanging out in the present moment and not getting lost in memories or plans or whatever we get lost in. And in that sense, what the meditation practice is doing is it's not something mystical, or it's not something particularly Eastern or foreign from something that's common for all of us. It's rather taking something which is common for all of us and strengthening it and developing it to a much higher pitch. And that is our capacity to be aware, to know what's going on. One of the really great insights that it's an insight practice, mindfulness, so we get a lot of insights as part of it. And one of the first great insights for people who are new to meditation is to realize, they sit down, how incredibly difficult it is to stay present. Some people report it as if the first insight they have is the mind is out of control. And they didn't know that, because they're so kind of busy kind of living our life and letting our mind kind of do whatever it wants. To actually stop and slow down and notice what your mind is doing and try to some degree keep your mind present in the present moment, it becomes so obvious that the mind is just wild. Just the thoughts think whatever they want, the feelings do whatever they want, and they're just kind of chasing after all these concerns and thoughts. And any attempt to kind of bring the mind into the present moment, just is very hard, because the mind recoils, the mind kind of races off again. Some people get discouraged at this point, but the point is not to be discouraged. The point is to be encouraged that you've had something, a real insight. You've really understood something about how your mind works that you didn't understand before, maybe. And that's the beginning of where the practice always begins, where we're at. It always begins, for people with a wild mind, it begins with appreciating the power of that wild mind and then learning how to be accepting of it, how to be compassionate of it. One of the most beautiful things about awareness is that awareness by itself does not judge. Awareness by itself doesn't want anything. Awareness by itself is not critical. Awareness by itself does not condemn. Awareness by itself is simply aware of what's happening. And because of this function, this quality of awareness, some people call it infinitely compassionate. And it's a wonderful salve, it's a wonderful alternative to the tremendous tendency for many people to be critical, self-critical, judgmental, to be consumed with desire and ambition, to be not compassionate, not accepting. So as we do this practice, it's very important to remember that those qualities of awareness, that awareness is always, in a sense, accepting of what it's aware of. It doesn't condemn or criticize. And what we're learning to do in meditation is learn to be, in a certain way, much more accepting of ourselves, much more accepting of our experience. Not to be at war with our experience, not to be at war with ourselves, but learn the art of kind of a certain kind of self-acceptance where we hold ourselves with a compassion, a kindness, friendship. And so the meditation becomes a way, the mindfulness becomes a way of strengthening not only our awareness, but also our capacity for self-compassion and compassion for others. A certain kind of acceptance, a certain kind of open-heartedness, a certain kind of allowing ourselves to be who we are. So in these 5 weeks, I'm going to lay out the instructions for mindfulness practice in a systematic way. By the end of the 5 weeks, I hope you have some general sense of how to bring mindfulness to most or all areas of your life, aspects of your experience. But we'll do that slowly. In the first week, we'll talk mostly about the basic meditation posture and mindfulness of breathing. And then we'll begin expanding out the range of experience from that. Next week, we'll talk about the mindfulness of the body, being embodied, having a sense of how to be in your body, how to be present for your bodily experience, is phenomenally important for mindfulness, phenomenally important for Buddhist practice as a whole. And so it's very important to kind of really learn how to be in your body more. And then the following week we're going to talk about emotions, places for many people very difficult, and learn how to bring mindfulness to emotions, how to look at them directly and how to relate to them with the awareness, with compassion, with acceptance. And then the fourth week we'll talk about how to bring mindfulness to our thoughts, to thinking. And it's a little bit of a surprise to some people to learn that this meditation includes our thinking, because some people think that thinking is the enemy of meditation. The point of meditation is to have no thoughts at all. And that's not the case for our particular style of meditation. It's rather to learn how to see our thinking clearly, how to be mindful of them, how not to be caught by them or entangled with them, but rather be free of them. Not free of them in the sense of they're gone, but free and not being entangled with them. And then the fifth week, we'll talk about how to bring mindfulness into the rest of our daily life, into our work, our activities of daily life. So that's the plan. If some people like to, if they miss a class, they like to get the tapes because we're taping them. And Allison here makes these tapes available. And you can talk to her. If you know you're going to miss a class, you can order ahead of time or after you, whatever. Whatever way you want. These are taped each week. In the tradition that I teach in, the Buddhist tradition, we put a high value on generosity, on offering the teachings and the practice in a generous spirit, to offer them freely. And so it's basically one of those values is not to charge for what we teach, not to charge for the instructions or the teachings. And partly it's kind of a very simple reason is to not let money stand in the way of someone hearing the teachings and receiving them so that people can come freely, whatever their means are. But more importantly, I think because it's a part of the exchange of so that the feeling of the whole system is one of goodwill and generosity, as opposed to the kind of the exchange system, monetary exchange system that people are most used to in our economy here. So we have a more exchange system of goodwill rather than what you're used to. So maybe some of you are not used to this kind of system. But what it means is that we put out two baskets in the hallway there if you would like to make a donation for these evenings. And there's two baskets. One basket is to help pay for the rent. Because we pay the friends for the use of this room, and it's nice if all of us share with paying for those. And we have a few other expenses. We publish a newsletter and things like that. And it's nice that everyone who participates in our event kind of shares with the basic cost of putting it on. If everyone donated a dollar or two for the rent basket, that would more than cover our cost. That would be great. It'd help us be a little more comfortable with our expenses. And the other basket is called for a teacher donation. And if you'd like to make a donation, in this case for me, since I'm the teacher, you're welcome to do that. My livelihood comes completely by the donations that people provide me in my role as a teacher. I'm a full-time teacher. And so that's for you to do as you wish. Sometimes I've made a suggestion for how much people might want to donate or suggest a donation amount for this. I'm of mixed minds of whether that's a wise thing to do or useful thing to do. Maybe today, this time, we won't do it. So it's for you to decide what you'd like to do out there with the basket. Are there any questions about logistics or anything that, so far you'd like to ask before we get started here? Everything seems clear enough so far as an introduction. Okay, well, let's just start then. Jump right in to the actual meditation practice itself. And I put a great value on cultivating a good meditation posture, sitting posture for meditation purposes. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about posture, and then we'll do some meditation. Posture meditation can be done either in on the floor or sitting on the floor, or it can be done in a chair. There's some value in doing it on the floor. One of the values is you get your center of gravity really a lot lower than in a chair. And we tend to be more stability when the center of gravity is lower. And so it's easier to let go of the body. It's actually easier to relax in a very deep way, I think, sitting on the floor. And there are some other values, of kind of physiological values, sitting on the floor. But they're not that great, those values, and it's fine to sit in the chair if that's what you need to do. However, when you sit in the chair, the recommendation is that you don't use the backrest. Now, some people have to use a backrest, and it's fine to use a backrest. The great beauty of mindfulness is you can do it in any posture at all. You can be a couch potato and still be mindful. But, in the long term, you're doing yourself a disservice if you just always meditate like a couch potato. Your back will go out and things eventually. There's a value in not using the backrest if you can avoid it. And part of it is that one of the goals of Buddhist practice is to, in some sense, become self-reliant. And there's a wonderful interplay between what we do with our body and our inner psychological, psychic life. And if we can develop more physical self-reliance, it actually helps the inner psychic process of becoming, in an inner way, self-reliant also. It allows, if you don't use the backrest, it allows for a different kind of relaxation to happen in your body. If you relax kind of into a chair, there's actually, you'll find in the long term, it actually limits how much you can relax. But if you take a balanced, aligned posture, it actually allows a deeper level of letting go in the body than you can if you're kind of slumping in a chair. It's kind of like if a person is always kind of hunched over like this, they can relax more and more, but there's not much movement for the shoulders to relax into anymore. But if they're sitting up straight, then the shoulders can begin to kind of relax down much further. They have much more room to move into. So the same thing with sitting in a chair with a backrest. So if you need to, it's fine. I'm not trying to just, some of you will feel self-conscious now, but the point of meditation is to help you overcome your self-consciousness, so you're in the right place. So a few points about sitting on a chair. Let's start with the floor. The classic way of sitting, of course, is cross-legged. And I recommend you don't actually cross your legs, but rather have one foot and one leg in front of the other. You see how I'm sitting here. And one of the reasons for that is that so both feet are on the ground, both knees are on the ground. And one of the reasons for that is that it's relatively symmetrical to do that. And so the body is relatively symmetrical and balanced. If you sit in the lotus postures, there's quarter lotus, you put your foot up on your thigh. There's half lotus, you put your foot up on your... quarter lotus is you put your foot up on your calf. Half lotus, you put your foot up on your thigh. And full lotus is you put both feet up on both thighs, hopefully with the toes hanging over the edge. And now, full lotus is pretty good. And it's basically a wonderful yogic posture. And you get, it really is helpful for meditation. There's a, or at least for concentration. It's kind of like it does wonderful things physiologically to your body to do this, sit this way. It's kind of an uplifting, lightening feeling in the body, in the spine, in the stomach. It's probably one of the more optimal postures for, not for your knees. But it's one of the, it's really, I find it really great for my back. It's one of my best, for my back. It really helps lower back problems if you can sit this way. And it helps really release tension in your stomach. And it's really a great way to sit. It helps the shoulders a lot. And there's kind of physiological, kind of energetic things which are really helpful. But I don't really encourage people to sit this way. Partly because the wonderful physiological benefits that come from it sometimes become props for people, kind of crutches for people. And if you sit the way I recommend this way, You have no, you're not getting any help. You're just left with yourself in a kind of very direct, simple way. And that's ultimately the, you know, what we want to do in mindfulness is just be left alone, just see ourselves as we are. Not how we want to be, but how we actually are. So this is relatively symmetrical, and so that's a good way of sitting. It's also the easiest for most people, so you don't cross your legs at all. And it's helpful to sit on a cushion, to get up off the floor with your butt. And part of the reason for that is that it helps bring lets the knees fall down on the ground. If you sit flat on the ground, it's sometimes hard to get the knees down for some people. And you might want to experiment with how high you sit. Some people, if your hips are really tight, you can sit the higher you want to sit so you get your knees down. If your hips are really open, you can sit really low. Everyone can sit cross-legged this way, I think. Most people can sit this way if they get high enough. But if you get really high, at some point all your cushions and, you know, higher and higher becomes like this wonderful slide effect. And you slide right off, so... So you can sit on a round cushion, which is kind of a classic thing to do. And the usual way of sitting on a round cushion is to sit not flat down in the middle, but rather to sit on the front third of it, kind of on the slope of it. And that'll help the... it kind of helps the pelvis tip forward, tilt forward slightly. And when the pelvis tips, tilts forward slightly, it helps bring the knees down. And it also gives a little bit of strength to the curve in your lower part of your back. Some people are a little bit too flat there. In meditation posture, you want to ever so slightly accentuate a normal curve. You don't want to be over-arched, but just have a little bit more strength there. Now, if you can't get your knees down, you can get some other pillows, for example, and prop up your knees. So that they're not kind of being stretched too much, and that can be helpful for some people. Sometimes one knee, sometimes both knees. Some people like to sit on these crescent moons, these pillows, rather than round pillows. They give a different kind of support for your weight and your thighs and your butt, and that seems to work well for some people. And some people like to sit on these benches. Now, in the benches, you don't sit cross-legged, but rather you sit on your knees. And you just like this, so that your legs are underneath the bench, your feet are underneath the bench, and you're sitting on it. So for people who want to be on the floor but can't sit cross-legged, this is a wonderful alternative to sit this way. And it does not quite as stable as cross-legged, but it's pretty good to sit this way. Allison also sells these things. If you want to buy cushions from her or benches, she has those. And there are other places around you can buy them. I think East West Book has them. You can go over there and buy them. But Allison has a good deal. It's one of the best deals around. So, you know, if you're interested. And also, some people like to sit on mats. Especially if you find your legs falling asleep a lot. Sometimes sitting on a softer cushioning can help. And so people will sit on mats to get a little more cushioning. And Allison has those too. So the idea is to... Basically, the important idea, the important point is to sit in such a way that you can sit straight with your back. So your back is upright and alert, straight, good back posture. That's really the central and most important aspect of good meditation postures. Have a back that's really well supported and upright, not leaning forward or hunched over or leaning to the side. And one way to help you do that if you're on the floor is to take your fists on either side of your hips on the floor and lift yourself almost off your cushion. And as you do that, you can actually do this in the chair too. And then let your chest come out and let your shoulders come back a little bit. And then as you release your weight on your hands, let your shoulders roll back and let yourself settle straight down. And maybe you'll find your shoulders kind of more hanging then. And it's a little bit easier maybe to relax the stomach then in that kind of way. And you're kind of more upright and alert. You can do anything with your hands that's where both hands are basically doing the same thing. So symmetrical. I like often to have them on my knees. palms down. Some people like having palms up. Some people like to have the hands in front of them. The classic way in Buddhism is to have the hands together, which is actually a very nice thing to do because the hands and legs and kind of the lower belly all kind of come together at the central, you know, center of gravity area right here. And it's quite a nice way of sitting, like this or like this. If you have your hands resting in your heels, sometimes depending on the proportions of your arms to your torso, you can be pulling your shoulders forward and create some strain here. So some people will get some towel or sweater or something and put it on their ankles so their hands can be higher up. If you're sitting, and then we keep, so the idea is to keep that straightness of the spine going up through your neck. So your head is not pointing forward, but actually kind of balanced on top of your shoulders. And we keep our mouth closed, and it's useful to rest the tongue up against the roof of the mouth. In this tradition, we sit with our eyes closed, and just gently close the eyes. And some people find it helpful to kind of have an inward gaze when they're kind of sitting, kind of look inwards, and it makes the eyes more restful. If it doesn't make the eyes more restful, then it's don't do that. If you're sitting in a chair, the usual suggestion is you have both feet parallel to each other with the feet both on the ground, flat on the ground, so the feet are not crossed. Some people like to have their legs spread out. It gives them more stability, but I don't know why exactly it is, but the usual suggestion is to have them parallel to each other. And but it's also important to have the knees higher than the hips. Because then it's all too easy for the lower back to kind of cave out and have back problems. So make sure your knees are not higher than your hips. Some people like to have them slightly lower than the hips. And so if you have long legs, then you can put a little cushion on your chair and sit higher. If you have to use a backrest, if you can only use a support for your lower back, that's better than using the whole backrest. If you have to use the whole backrest, that's fine. Some people can't do sitting meditation at all, and they'll do laying down meditation. I think Shyla's in the back demonstrating that. It's kind of hard to see her because she's behind the chairs, but she's the shining model of how you can do it laying down. So it can be done in many ways. Any questions about the posture? Anything that seemed clear enough, or anything? Yes.
What if your feet don't touch the floor?
Oh, then you can just put something underneath your feet, get a pillow or something to support them. I think it's good to have them supported. Yes.
Is there a particular lying down posture that you'd recommend?
Yeah, you lay on your back.
I can't see.
Yeah, you lay on your back and have your your knees up, but your feet closer to your torso.
Can't see her.
You can demonstrate it. Boy, this is a bit popular, huh? Usually, like this. This is the usual way. Some people have their hands together like this, because then if they fall asleep, the hands will wake them up. That's the danger of laying down, is that it's a little bit harder to do meditation laying down because it's easy to fall asleep. It's kind of similar to you know what we do when we are laying in bed, and it can lend itself to a little bit easier in sitting meditation to kind of complacency, kind of getting kind of spaced out or something. It's a good thing to develop the ability to do meditation in the laying down posture. But you should know that I don't recommend pragmatically, unless you really have to because of back or problems or something. Don't do it just because you're lazy.
Is there are there some traditions where you keep your eyes open?
Yes, and sometimes in this mindfulness tradition, some teachers will teach that also. But it was most associated with the Zen tradition and some Tibetan traditions to keep the eyes open. It's not a big deal for us, eyes open and eyes closed. We generally encourage people to keep their eyes closed, partly because there's a the sense of being in touch with our physical sensations and being present for our body, for our breath, seems to be a little bit easier if we're not distracted with our sight. But you know, it can be done in any way. So if a person finds it uncomfortable to keep the eyes closed, they can keep them open. The usual way then is to keep them open, but pointing about 45 degrees down to the ground. Have the eyes kind of half open, and kind of have your focus as if you're looking at a mountain far in the distance. It's some people find sitting on the floor difficult because of their hips, their backs, whatever. If you're going to do meditation over a long term, you'll get a lot of benefits from taking the time of kind of working through your initial discomfort and begin stretching out the body a little bit. And it really is, it's really great to have a good, stable sitting posture. It'll serve you very, very well to do that. Okay, so that's the basic idea of posture. If you'd like to take, why don't we just take 30 seconds or so, stand and stretch. You've been sitting for a while. If someone wants to try the bench or this crescent pillow that's up here, you're welcome to try it. One of the central tasks of mindfulness meditation is to help train ourselves to be in the present moment, to help learn how to relax into the present moment, learn how to strengthen our ability to stay in the present moment, whatever language you like, but find some way to kind of learn to stay in the present moment so the mind doesn't pull us off into our future thinking, our past thinking, our fantasies, whatever we might be caught up in. And one of the ways to develop our capacity to stay in the present moment is to begin to focus on the breath. The breath is a very, very simple event. Your breathing is always happening in the present moment. I'm sure you breathed yesterday, and I hope you breathe tomorrow. But the experience of breathing is always a present moment experience. So it becomes kind of a touchstone for being in the present. It becomes an anchor or aid, a wonderful friend for developing our ability to stay in the present moment. Some people will find the breath to be kind of mundane, kind of uninteresting initially. The more you do meditation, I think the more interesting and fascinating the breath becomes. And our ability to stay with the alternating rhythms of breath, the sensations of breathing, becomes a wonderful place of being home with ourselves, and a wonderful place where we can learn how to enter into feelings of calm, joy, relaxation in our body and our mind. But the breath is kind of like, you know, the whetstone where we begin sharpening the knife of our awareness, sharpening our ability to be present. And it has all these kind of wonderful byproducts, wonderful side effects of calm and joy that come with it. As we stay with the breathing, stay present for the breathing, developing our capacity to be in the present by being with the breath, many of the normal concerns we're so preoccupied with stop being fed by our being involved with them. And as our preoccupation stops feeding our fears, our ambitions, our fantasies, our planning, our remembering, or whatever it is our mind does, our tendency to keep getting involved in those mental activities begins to wane. And the energy of distraction, the fragmentation that affects many of us, begins to quiet down. And people begin getting calmer and having a more sense of being unified or settled on themselves. Many people find that a busy life, kind of driven life, that they become fragmented from themselves. They're going in so many different directions and they kind of lose touch with themselves. And part of what happens as we stay very simply and begin channeling our attention, our presence into the breathing, there's often a sense of kind of wholeness that begins developing because we stop kind of going off in many different directions. So the breath is a very powerful place to begin meditation practice. Some people, well, let's just do it then before I... So begin by taking a comfortable but alert posture. Letting your spine be alert, upright, alive. And then gently close your eyes. And it's useful at the beginning of a meditation to take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe in deeply, to let that inhalation help connect you to your body. And then as you exhale deeply, to let your body relax around the spine, around that alert spine. Letting go of the easy tensions that can be left let go of. Anyway, it works when it doesn't work. So it works when it works means that you're able to stay present for your breathing and you find yourself settling more into the present moment. You're relaxing more as you stay with the breath and stay as continuously you can with the breath as possible. It works by not working is when it's difficult to stay with the breath or you try to bring yourself to the breath and the mind kind of goes off into other thoughts. It's working because you're beginning to get insight into how the mind works. You're beginning to get insight that the mind is very distracted or preoccupied with certain things. And you get to see that very, very clearly. It's kind of like if there's a river, a little stream that's very calm and but it's flowing and very clear water, very calm, you know, clear, and it's sometimes very hard to tell how fast the water is flowing. Maybe you don't even think it's flowing at all, but if you put a stick in the water, then you can see the water rushing by the stick and it forms little wavelets and awake as the water flows by, and so you can see the speed of it. Or if you're in a train maybe and you look, you know, you have a great vista of great plains. You might not be able to tell how fast you're going, even if you see mountains far in the distance. But if you have some reference point that's a lot closer, a telephone post that's right next to the train, it whizzes by. Wow, you know, I'm going really fast. It's very helpful to have a reference point sometimes to really see what's going on. And with the mind, it's the same way. If the mind is just kind of busily running around doing whatever it wants, kind of merrily preoccupied and driven and filled with its concerns, you can hardly even know what you're thinking or what you're doing. You don't really see what's happening. But if you have a reference point from which to notice that, you can see, oh, my mind's out of control, or my mind is really busy or really preoccupied. So the reference point, we create one by trying to be with our breathing. And we see how difficult it is. We see the mind keeps going off. And rather than being discouraged, you can actually feel encouraged. Oh yeah, now I'm really seeing something true about my mind. And then you keep, of course, coming back to your breath and keep coming back, appreciating how difficult it is, really telling you something about the power of your mind and how it works. Many people have a strong conditioning that when they do something, they get very discouraged if they're not successful at it. In mindfulness meditation, we're trying to do mindfulness of breath best we can, but there's no need to particularly be successful at it. I mean, it helps a lot. We strengthen our mindfulness, of course, by doing it. But you can really appreciate that you're actually learning to be mindful of what distracts you, how your mind is actually functioning. And you should really appreciate that. And if you appreciate that, then it's a lot easier to come back to the breath and rest there. But if you find your mind wandering off a lot, and then you get into judgment and criticism and feelings of failure, it's actually harder than to stay in the present moment. Does it make sense what I said? Makes enough sense? So isn't it great that it works when it doesn't work?
Yeah.
The breath is intimately connected with our inner psychology and our fears and our holding, our tensions and all that. And one of the wonderful things to do in daily life is to begin becoming aware of how your breathing is. Do you breathe from your chest? Do you breathe with a tight stomach, with a relaxed stomach? What's happening with your shoulders as you breathe? Because a feeling of being driven, a feeling of being afraid, of being scared or shy or ambitious, you know, all these different emotions we have often get the relationships we form with the world are often represented or held in the way we breathe. If you're kind of driving along someplace and you come to a red light, and you take a few moments while you're waiting for the light to turn green to feel your breathing and be with your breathing, it gives you an opportunity to notice that maybe because of your hurriedness to get somewhere, your breathing is tensed up. And you give it a chance maybe to discover a more easeful breath. Just take 2 or 3 minutes to kind of connect to your breath and see what's going on and maybe begin relaxing. Mindfulness of the breathing is like a great lubricator of life. It makes life a lot easier. Because as we stay more mindful of the breathing and connect to it, it's harder to let the breath stay contracted or tight in the way that often happens as we live a reactive life. So it's very useful throughout the day, not just in meditation practice, but to connect to your breathing, find out what's going on with your breath. Just stay with your breath a little bit, just to kind of somehow soften the preoccupations of the mind. Standing in line in the supermarket rather than reading the National Enquirer headlines, or whatever you do, just stand there and just kind of breathe mindfully. And just, you know, no one has to know you're doing it. And you'll probably find yourself in a very different space than you were if you didn't do that. There's lots of opportunities, little spaces during the day to check in with the breathing. And it gets very helpful. You get a lot of information about yourself by checking in with your breath. And also it allows you to kind of just let go a little bit and relax. I know some people in busy, crowded work environments will periodically go off to the bathroom, not to use it for the usual functions, but rather it's just a quiet place to be with their breathing for 5 minutes or 3 minutes or 2 minutes. And it's a wonderful thing just to be with the breath. Some people, before they answer a telephone, you know, some people just answer automatically. You know, it's like the faster the answer, you know, I don't know, well, the more respectful it is for the person calling, or I don't know what. But they let the phone ring 3 or 4 times. And they use that time to just be with the breathing for 2 breaths. And some people find that very helpful, because if you're with your breath for a little bit, it's very hard to be with your preoccupations. And so they begin to relax a little bit. And you begin noticing what's actually happening for you, as opposed to just not noticing. So anybody have any questions or comments about that experience, about meditating with the breathing? Was it difficult, easy? Yes?
I was very surprised to find that when I did sit on the edge of the chair and sit up straight, I didn't think I'd be able to do it, but it actually became easier as I persisted.
Great. Thank you. Yes? Yes?
The same question, since this is the first time I sat on the floor, does that get easier?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It gets easier. You know, the body adapts. You know, body is malleable, you know, and slowly with time it'll stretch and open up, and the hips and the knees and the thighs and the hamstrings and stuff and the back. And if it's really challenging physically to sit on the floor, maybe you don't want to kind of push yourself, because then you're just discouraged about meditation, you don't want to do it. But it is really useful, you know, to begin slowly cultivating that. I know some people who don't sit in a cross-legged position when they meditate because it's so challenging, but they'll do it when they watch television as a way of slowly beginning to, you know, 5 minutes first at one time and then, you know, the next day or whatever, next week or whatever. It's just, you know, it feels like kind of a gentle place to begin softening the body for this posture. Yes?
For me, what you said about if it works when it doesn't work, because I tried one of those stress management, I got more stressed out. I did. I mean, I couldn't control my mind and felt like failing system, and then I quit.
Right, and then you can feel guilty. You know, all kinds of wonderful things you can feel. You know, if you're judging yourself that way. But yeah, it works when it doesn't work. And different people have different abilities to get concentrated. And ultimately, you know, the point is not so much just to be able to be concentrated. The point is to have a real clear seeing what's actually happening for you right now. And to have some particular kind of very broad, accepting kind of relationship to that. And some people never are good at following the breath, but it's very helpful to do the mindfulness practice and try to be with the breath, because they learn to develop that accepting spaciousness around, you know, what's actually going on. One way of talking about meditation practice is talk about creating more space for your experience, for yourself. You know, if you're in a kind of many people crowded in a small little closet or space, it's kind of, you know, claustrophobic and difficult to maneuver and stuff. It's not so comfortable, maybe. But suddenly, if you all kind of move into this huge space, spacious ballroom, it feels suddenly much more comfortable. Like it's really spacious and comfortable, and if it's a high ceiling, then you feel really inspired. You know, a great cathedral or whatever. Space, you know, physical space can give people sometimes a great sense of ease. And we're trying to do, in a sense, is to let there be more space in the mind. The mind that's running after many things and preoccupied by many fears and concerns has very little space for it. But as we bring mindfulness, we don't have to get rid of anything, but we kind of like, the kind of acceptance is a kind of acceptance that let there be all this spaciousness around, this space around it, where we're not gripping onto it, we're not gripped by it, or we're kind of, kind of just let it be. Someone else.
I was just so surprised at how frenetic the energy is inside. If you would, make me think how I can't be so confident or arrogant to think that all the answers are going to be in my mind.
Ah.
So it's incredible.
There's a lot. Many of us have a phenomenal amount of momentum from our stress, our clinging, our drivenness, our preoccupations, our kind of the way we live our life. And that momentum is carried in our body. And it's unreasonable to expect us to sit down and be completely serene. But rather, when we sit down, we start noticing that momentum. And the momentum begins slowly to unwind itself. And you can't necessarily, you're not necessarily in charge of how fast that happens. You're in charge of making the space so it can happen. And I think that the frantic energy will slowly begin to dissipate with time. And then in terms of figuring things out, the more relaxed the body is, the sense people have, the feeling people have, is that the more the body then participates in wise understanding. It's not just a matter of thinking about things, but they kind of all are kind of we have much greater capacity to relate and understand ourselves in life than we can. Our thinking is a very, very narrow and limited way of approaching life. And as the body gets more relaxed, it's almost as if the body then participates with its wisdom, its understanding, with our whole understanding and decision-making has to happen. So it's very helpful to begin. So we begin by just opening to that energy, and then it unwinds itself. Yes?
You said something that sparked a thought that I've been having, which is that a lot of the things that we are attached to create a lot of momentum. There's some positiveness to that in my life, and I'm finding that part of the resistance to the meditation is sort of fear of losing that momentum.
How does it help you in your life?
Gets a lot of stuff done.
Uh-huh.
Keeps my house clean.
Uh-huh.
Keeps my kids fed, and you know, from that perspective, the drive to have things a certain way. To me, or I perceive it to as being something that actually is positive.
It might be positive in some ways, and there certainly can be benefits. You might be greater benefits from trying to do it in a different way. There are other sources of motivation inside of us that can be very efficient and get us to do things, you know, even faster, whatever, that don't have to come from the kind of motivation that gives momentum. In Buddhism, they distinguish between motivation or action in the world, which creates traces or creates momentum, and that which doesn't create any at all. So it's possible to be very busy and very involved without the mind clinging or grasping or being pushed or being afraid or being angry or being, you know, concerned about self-centered concerns or whatever. And because all those things leave traces or momentum. So you might experiment. Maybe there's other ways of doing it. And
I think that there's just a fear of an unknown, if that's what has... I've seen some positiveness of, with that momentum, not knowing what you're speaking of from a personal experience.
Oh, it can be very threatening for some people to let go of the normal ways in which they operate in the world and believe that there's some other way of doing it. You know, it's like, you know, a lifetime of a certain way, you know, it's kind of ingrained. And so sometimes a meditative life involves it's a little bit of a rocky period of kind of uncertainty, or because we're kind of begin experimenting with new ways without the normal old ways that we're doing it. And that's, you know, healthy at times. The other thing, I don't know if it's your case, but sometimes when people have a lot of momentum that keeps them going, just going, and they actually get a lot done, they're maybe missing out on what's most important. Like, I've known people who are really efficient in their home life and take care of their kids and everything, and get really good at getting the lunches made and the kids out the door and cleaning and picking them up and doing, you know, getting them to this, that, and that. But there's no sense of any time for a heartfelt connection with the children. And so they're getting a lot done, and the kids are becoming, you know, are very clean and everything. But maybe that's not what the kids need. Maybe they need to be a little more sloppy and sloppy house, and but have a mom who's really there for them in a loving way or something. Sometimes it's useful to look at our priorities and look at what actually the consequences are and what's being left out. And yes?
I found it helpful when you said that, commented that that it was sort of a good resting place when you were meditating, because when I kind of, when my mind was distracted, I found myself saying to myself, why am I doing this? What, you know, what is, you know, so what if I'm with my breath? What's the point? In other words, I mean, I've done a little bit of reading, and I understand, but it takes me a while to figure out the point, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, Clinton, when in the campaign, had to boil it down to it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah.
And anyway, I guess when you're with the breath, when you're with the breath, is that by definition pleasant and fulfilling and rewarding, so that you want to be with the breath more?
The more you do the practice, the more often that's the case. And there can be a tremendous love affair actually with the breath, but as with all lovers, you know, it can be rocky sometimes. You know, sometimes it's not pleasant to be with the breath, and so then what's very helpful for a meditator is with, like with a partner, is to have some sense of commitment. If there isn't a sense of commitment, then that, you know, gets through the rocky times, the relationship doesn't really develop. So same thing with meditation. There are definitely going to be rocky times, but you hang in there, and in the long term, it gets more and more pleasant and easier and very rewarding to be with the breath overall.
And how long? how long, like for me, that period that we meditated was a pretty long time to concentrate that much. So I'm just wondering when you give us our assignments.
Oh, okay, thank you. Okay, so the way that this introductory course works best is during the week, intervening in between the classes, you sit at home every day. I really encourage you to do that. I mean, we're such a soft tradition that I can't tell you you're required to do that, but I wish I could sometimes. and sit every day at home. And the more you kind of practice with these instructions, the easier it'll be to understand the instructions the following week. And the more rewarding it'll be, I think, in the long term. So if you're new to meditation, then why don't you start with 15 minutes a day? And then each day, each week that we go into this course, or the next few weeks, add 5 minutes until you get to 30 minutes. And then stop at 30, and then when you get to the end of the 5 weeks, you can reevaluate, and if 30 minutes is still too long, you can back up a little bit to 20. Or you might want to go further. Some people will sit for 30 minutes, sometimes some people 45, 40 minutes. Some people sit longer every day. But start, if you're new, start with 15, and next week do 20, the next week 20, 25, the next week 30. And if you do it every day, you'll find it gets easier, the length of time. Most people will do the meditation in the morning, usually early in the morning when they first wake up, soon after they first wake up. If that doesn't work for your life, then do it, maybe some people prefer to do it in the evening or in the afternoon when they come home or something. It's helpful to have some kind of committed, regular time that you do it. So it's not just kind of random, like when will I feel like doing it today, when I feel like it. It's best to have some commitment with our daily, regular meditation practice. Sit every day for a certain length of time. That's kind of, you decided how long it's going to be. And ideally, hopefully, if your life is not too complicated, the same time every day. And part of the function of the commitment is so that the meditation practice doesn't belong to that part of your life that has to do with your preferences. Many of us are driven by our preferences, our likes and dislikes. And not that it's necessarily bad, but it's very, very powerful to have some commitment in our life which doesn't relate to our likes and dislikes any particular day, our whims and all that. Because meditation practice is supposed to help us see ourselves as we actually are. And if you actually sit, you can have the commitment to sit every day, then over time, a whole range of who you are gets to be processed and seen through meditation. If you only sit when you want to, your preference, where you feel like it, some people only meditate when they feel good, or some people only meditate when they feel lousy. But the idea is to include all of us in the practice, and not to kind of let it just be in a realm of what we want to pay attention to. So the commitment is really helpful for that, to take it out of our preferences. And it's actually a tremendous aid to becoming a freer person, to have the meditation be outside of our likes and dislikes, within reason, of course. But some people find that it's useful to find some little place in their home, a corner of a bedroom, that just kind of relegated to just being, the only thing that happens there is their meditation practice. So that when they go there, it's associated just with meditation practice. There's not other associations there. They have a cushion or a mat in the corner or something, or an empty room if you have such a thing in your house. Some people wonder, how do I keep time? And one way to keep time is to get a... There's so many wonderful gadgets nowadays. You should go find an electric time gadget that's silent, that just kind of has a nice alarm after, set it for 20 minutes. And I'm sure you could find something. Some people will tape 20 minutes of silence. And then when they're going to meditate, they just stick their tape, you know, their tape in the tape recorder and do start to play. And after 20 minutes, bing, that's one way. So there's various ways of doing it. But it's helpful to have some kind of timer so that you're not wondering, oh, is it, you know, is it 20 minutes yet? Is it 20 minutes yet? And, you know. And then then you have the experience of sitting there, you know, set it for 20 minutes, and you, after 10 minutes, you say, this is forever. I must have forgotten to set the timer. You know, this is, you know, and then you start noticing this tremendous kind of way in which you get driven and this compulsion, this kind of, you know, frantic, this, you know, it has, you know, I've been sitting here for 3 hours, you know, and why? And then you look and it's like in 3 minutes. So it's, you know, the mind is really, you know, it's really wonderful, mindfulness, because the mind is so wonderful. It's just, you know, so amazing. You'll be more amazed. The more you study your mind, the more you'll be amazed. It's more amazing than the Grand Canyon. It's just like, wow. It just, you know, in all kinds of ways. It's just one of the most astounding, beautiful, wonderful, awesome, stupendous, sublime things that the universe has produced. And not that it's all this way, but someone once said, it's a blessing to be able to laugh at oneself, because then you'll never stop being humored. Any other concerns today? Yes, please.
Well, I appreciate what you just said about how wonderful the mind is, but it did cross my mind that, you know, maybe this is something I don't want to know about. And I was sitting here and I was thinking, well, you know, oh well. Why not just take a chance? But I think that, I mean, that came back once, twice, two or three times.
I think that's very significant. And many people have areas of their life which they don't want to open up to, or don't want to be present for. They shut down, and it can be very threatening and frightening sometimes to do a meditation practice that involves opening. Because as your mind gets more relaxed and more open and more present, it's very hard to maintain and keep the energy that it takes to use the energy it takes to hold things at bay. It's a tremendous psychic cost to not look at things, to not look at certain issues or look at certain feelings or whatever that's going on. And as we meditate, we start noticing that the psychic physiological cost of holding things at bay, and it's very hard to maintain it. And then there are periods of time where people will then get frightened or afraid or act out or criticize the meditation teacher, it's his fault, you know, or whatever. And so I think it's very, very important for you to explore that area and think deeply about that, and maybe talk to some other people, talk to me about you know, what you think might be the value of staying shut down to it, or what might be the value of opening to it, and such things. It's not possible to be free, and freedom is the goal of Buddhism, Buddhist practice. It's not possible to be free if the mind is compartmentalized and keeping some things out. It's, you know, it's the definition of freedom is that nothing's left out. So,
awake.
Awake to the whole show. Last one, I think, and then, yes.
I just, as I was sitting there, I was going through just an amazing amount of pain in my back, like, to the point where I had to actually lay down because I couldn't deal with it anymore. Is this common for some people, and what do you recommend?
It can be common. If you're new to sitting this way, mm-hmm. Do you have back problems?
Yeah.
So if you have back problems, you want to be really careful. And maybe for you, sitting in a chair with a backrest is what you need to do. But you might also, we might ask at the end, if you you stay behind, I can look at your posture. And sometimes working one-on-one with a person with a posture can really help alleviate where the pain is or the trouble is. It's very important to get good support and all kinds of things. And there are some people, you know, if it's structural difficulty, and generally you want to try to find a way that avoids that kind of pain because it's a structural pain difficulty. But there's also a lot of pain in our body, in our backs, for example, that comes from the way we've held ourselves. So, for example, if a person's always kind of held themselves this way, and they begin sitting straight and begin relaxing, one of the things they're going to become aware of as they relax that is the strain, the tension of relaxing, letting go of that those contracted muscles. And they might, it's a necessary part of the process then is to let yourself go through the pain that it takes to let those things open up and relax. So pain isn't necessarily, you know, sometimes pain is part of the process. And we have to learn to be patient then with it rather than avoiding it. If we keep avoiding it, you know, then, you know, we'll never go through it and open to that greater space that's possible. But if it's structural, you know, I'll look at your posture, we can work on it. And if it's so bad that you had to lay down, then probably you're better off, you know, if you could sit in a chair, probably better off.
Well, it's interesting because my lower back is where I typically have pain. Yeah. But I kind of felt it in my shoulders, but then as I did it longer, that did go away, but then this just got really intense down here. So I'm not sure what it is, but yeah. We can talk about that later.
Okay, great. So if any of you have further questions about this, please stay behind and we can talk about it. It's time to end. And oh, yes. Some of you have been here before a number of times. At the end of each evening, we have to rearrange the room, bring the chairs up in the corners and put two more rows into the middle. And so if those of you, especially if there's enough of you who have been around a little bit before and have a general sense, if you could stay and help with the chairs. And if you've been coming for some while and you never helped with the chairs, we need to have a certain number of people who are familiar with the arrangement. So it'd be good if you just helped, you know, just, you know, occasionally stay behind so you kind of know the scene in case there's a day when no one else can do it. Thank you all very much, and I hope this is useful, and I wish you a happy week.